Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to XBN. My name is Holly Pottle, and I'm a board member with Swap East. I'm going to be hosting tonight, and our guest is Jill Brenneman. It feels really weird calling Jill a guest because she's hosted so many shows on XBN herself, but we're glad to have her tonight as a guest. And if at any point in the show you have any questions or comments, please feel welcome to call in. The call-in number is 646-200-3136. Jill is the founder of Swap East, and she's in the process of organizing a campaign called Sex Workers Against Rape. Jill has experience working in both the forced and consensual sectors of the sex industry, and she has firsthand experience with the harms of criminalizing prostitution. So welcome, Jill.
Well, thank you for having me, Holly. It's great to be on this side.
You know, you're kind of like switching sides of the mic tonight, so to speak. I'd like to start just by asking you about Sex Workers Against Rape. It's a campaign you're in the process of organizing, and so can you tell us more about that?
Sex Workers Against Rape, Holly, the idea behind it, and, you know, I'm kind of loosely working with other sex worker rights activists on this. The idea behind it is to speak about the harms that happen to sex workers, that happen as a result of criminalization, to take on issues of abuse and issues of rape against sex workers from a sex worker rights perspective. It's an issue that's often been, in my mind, co-opted by the prohibitionist / radical feminist aspect of the movement around the sex industry. And I think it's an issue that we need to take on as a sex worker rights movement ourselves, and that we can. So that's kind of the basis of the starting of it.
Yeah, I think it's great that it's really what you envision is really a sex worker-led campaign and led by sex workers and sex workers activists to fight abuses in the industry and really address, you know, how the criminalization of prostitution encourages these abuses. And I think that's so important, you know, to fight abuse in the sex industry without conflating, you know, all sex work with violence, which really does nothing to stop violence, you know, without promoting this whole really dangerous, violence is just part of the job description type attitude, to just really fight against, you know, the actual, you know, abuses that happen in the industry without conflating all prostitution or all sex industry work with abuse, kind of like with marriage. You know, there are some people who are abused in marriage, but that doesn't mean that we should go around saying that all marriage is abusive. I mean, maybe there are some people who do, but it does nothing. It really, that attitude kind of just waters down the whole issue of abuse, waters down the whole issue of violence, because if we're just going to say, well, all sex work is violence, then what do we do when somebody actually, you know, does experience violence in the sex industry?
Oh. You know, I completely agree. You know, the conflation of the two, to me, does such a disservice to both. You know, those who have suffered abuse, that have suffered harm at any length, and those who have not. And, you know, I've done both ends of the sex industry. You know, there have been aspects of it where I have been harmed, where it has not been consensual. There have been aspects of it for me which have been consensual and where I was not harmed. And you know, there's a vast difference just in the two experiences for myself. And, you know, I find researchers and academics, you know, that want to merge the two together and you know, perhaps they're well-intentioned, but it's a very poor semantic to just, you can't lump any population together, and it just does no good. And, you know, I think they're conflating the two together as a political tool to hammer this war that they've got embedded into their psychology and into their politics to abolish the sex industry, and that's not going to happen. I mean, that's just, it's never going to happen. I mean, we've been trying to abolish murder, and we've been trying to abolish war, and we've been trying to abolish, you know, slavery and so many evils since the dawn of time that they just, they haven't been abolished. You know, I mean, there were, you know, the United States dropped nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that wasn't enough of a message to stop war from ever happening again. Thus, some things are just going to happen. And to me, to take this abolitionist approach and say everyone is subject to this monstrous victimization, it takes away from the pain and the horror that victims have gone through, and it disenfranchises those who have not been victimized and who are saying they haven't been victimized.
And speaking of abolishing things, I mean, let's abolish violence against sex workers. Let's abolish the criminalization of prostitution. So, I mean, those are things that we should be, I think, focusing on abolishing. And that's why I've always, like, thought a lot of people will, you know, sometimes, or some people will call the prohibition side the abolitionist. But in a sense, I kind of see, you know, the sex worker advocacy side as the abolitionist, because we're the ones who are trying to abolish these repressive policies against sex work. So I guess that term can be used either way.
You know, I think that the whole prohibitionist political movement, you know, they've done a very good job manipulating the public into believing that the direction they're going is, you know, is this noble, high-minded direction, but they're maintaining a status quo of criminalization, and I hate to disappoint them, but abusers, generally speaking, are not stupid people, you know, and I think they're underestimating the intelligence of abusive, predatorial people, and predatorial people and abusive people know that if anyone is criminalized, if we are afraid of the authorities, if the authorities view us as criminals, if we can't go and be honest with, you know, the agencies that are supposed to protect us, if we can't be honest with our healthcare providers because what we're doing is illegal, if we can't be honest with the justice system, that's not going to abolish anything. That's empowering the very predatorial, abusive people that they claim to be opposed to.
Absolutely. And on the topic of violence and how the criminal and abuse and how the criminalization of prostitution encourages abuse, what I think is important for people to realize is that under the criminalization of prostitution, it's not just the clients and pimps who are perpetrating this abuse. In some cases, it's law enforcement officials who are enforcing these anti-prostitution laws, who are perpetrating the abuse and using these laws to basically get away with this abuse.
And I think that's something, that's a great point, and it's something that, is missed, and it's something that's happened to me in my own experiences where a police officer in uniform on duty more than once forced me into various acts, performing various acts upon them, and there was no secret who they were, what they did for a living, and essentially, if I didn't get it right, that I was going to get arrested afterward.
And, you know, thank you for bringing that up. That's a really powerful point because, you know, there's some people, you know, on the prohibition side who will say that, you know, prostitution is in and of itself a form of rape, but I don't agree with that. But I do think that what you just described can definitely be considered rape because that wasn't consensual sexual behavior. I mean, these police were basically, you know, forcing you to give them sexual services. And so it really wasn't consensual, and I would consider that rape. And I also consider it rape in cases where these undercover vice cops will trick prostitutes into thinking that they're clients, and then in some cases actually engage in sex acts with them before arresting them for prostitution and then blowing it off like, you know, well, I was just doing my job. I couldn't get a verbal agreement out of them to have sex for money, so I had to go further. I mean, again, what I just described is rape because that's not consensual. These sex workers didn't consent to have sex with somebody who was going to arrest them afterwards. They didn't consent to have sex with an undercover cop. They agreed to have sex with somebody who they thought was a client. So, I mean, and I'm just sitting here thinking like, yeah, there's rape in prostitution, and the criminalization of prostitution encourages it, not only from clients and pimps, but in some cases by law enforcement officials whose job it's supposed to be to serve and protect.
Well, and you know, it goes even beyond that. I mean, it involves judges, it involves district attorneys. You know, I mean, who make no secret of who they are. You know, it's like, you're going to do this for me. You're going to give me what I want, whether that be, you know, sex without a condom, whether that be a rougher form of sex, whether that be, you know, whatever kind of sex that they want, with the caveat that with them saying, you know, I am ex district attorney or ex judge, and it would not be very difficult for you to end up in my courtroom and whether they're going to act upon that or whether it's sheer bluff, under criminalization, you can't afford to take that risk. What if they're telling the truth? What if they are this judge? What if you do end up in their courtroom? I mean, I've been to court more than once in my life, you know, with nothing to do with the sex industry, and I don't care for judges. And the way they conduct themselves and the way they abuse power. And I certainly wouldn't want to risk it, you know, from the position of a sex worker.
Absolutely. And on the topic of, you know, police abuse, there was a letter posted recently. I'm going to pull it up on my computer right now, actually. You might have read it. It's about the anti-trafficking, you know, law in Cambodia. And I think what's important for people to understand is that some of these anti-trafficking policies really seem more focused on persecuting sex workers than on stopping human trafficking. And so anyway, this letter, it's a letter from the Asia Pacific Network of Sex Workers. And what it talks about are basically that Cambodia has recently passed an anti-trafficking law which equates all sex work with trafficking. And this has led to massive closures of brothels and widespread human rights abuses against sex workers. And I'm reading much of this directly from the letter. Sex workers have been forcibly detained in rehabilitation centers where they have been raped and robbed by police guards. And thousands of women have lost their livelihoods. And HIV-positive sex workers have great difficulty in assessing, it says ARVs. I'm not sure exactly what that acronym stands for, but I'm assuming it's some kind of a service that they would need, both inside and outside of detention centers. And basically, this legislation passed, Cambodian government passed this legislation to meet standards imposed by the U.S. government's trafficking in persons report. And so what's happening under this legislation pretty much equates all sex work with trafficking. And what's resulted in this is isn't that human trafficking's ending. It's not that forced labor's ending. That's not what's happening as a result of this. What's happening is that, according to this letter, sex workers are being detained in rehabilitation centers and raped and robbed by the police and guards. And so, I mean, we could probably sit here all night and, discuss how harmful this conflation is, how harmful it is to conflate all prostitution with trafficking. And this is one really serious example of that, what's happening in Cambodia. And it's basically, this legislation was passed to meet the standards imposed by the U.S. government's trafficking in persons report. And I don't see how this is really stopping forced labor or modern day slavery. And actually, at the end of the letter, it says in bold letters, don't be fooled by talk of rescuing sex slaves until you have heard our testimonials and seen video evidence of the brutality and misery this new law is causing. It's a very powerful letter, and like I said, really speaks to the harms of conflating all sex work with, or all sex industry work with human trafficking.
Well, and Cambodia is such a pronounced example of the failures of U.S. policies. And it's astonishing to me. The rise of the Khmer Rouge in the 70s came about largely because of the massive U.S. bombing of Cambodia during the Vietnam War. We then turned around and recognized, perhaps the most genocidal government in the modern era, the most genocidal government certainly since Nazi Germany. We recognized them as a legitimate government. We did nothing as a nation to stop that genocide, and we even continued to recognize the Khmer Rouge after they had been forcibly removed by the Vietnamese, and now we're back in Cambodian politics, once again dictating policies and politics that don't really make sense in the United States, and certainly don't make sense in the context of Cambodia, a nation that's still just trying to rebuild from a Holocaust and a Holocaust precipitated by the U.S. and it's just astonishing to me that how much power the United States has and how that power is once again causing harm in Cambodia.
Exactly. And for anybody he's interested, and I encourage people to really read this letter because it's an excellent letter, very powerful. It's posted on Bound Not Gag, which is, as you may know by now, the sex worker, a major sex worker advocacy discussion board. And the URL is really, really long, so I'm not going to read it, but the title of the post is Urgent Call to Action, Anti-Trafficking Law in Cambodia. And so let me ask you this. You are also a former sex work prohibitionist advocate. You are part of the radical feminist segment of the women's movement. And you've transitioned from that to becoming a leader in the sex workers' rights movement. And can you kind of describe that, like how you transitioned from being part of the radical feminist movement to the sex workers' rights movement? Or actually, for the people who aren't familiar with the radical feminism, because I know there are lots of different types of feminism, can you kind of explain exactly what radical feminism is and the stance on sex work?
The radical feminist stance on sex work, essentially, radical feminism looks at sex work not as employment, not as work, but as oppression of women, as bought and sold rape in all circumstances, as a patriarchal, misogynistic control of women by commodifying women as objects that can be purchased by men. And in that process, it essentially, radical feminism essentially, it defines all forms of the sex industry as prostitution, as what they term systems of prostitution. And then there are levels and degrees of that depending on the feminist. You know, I mean, some go as far as saying a cocktail waitress in Vegas or the Hooters girl or you know, an NFL cheerleader is a prostituted woman. And their basis is that no woman can choose to be in a sex industry under any circumstances, and that even if they believe they've chosen it, that their belief structure is incorrect, and that essentially they've been sold a bad bill of goods by the patriarchy. And you know, there are varying degrees of that genre of feminism. I kind of stumbled into that, you know, when I left the sex industry and was looking for counseling to deal with the abuse that I suffered in the sex industry, and ran into a radical feminist program, a program which, ironically, I to this day still have great regard for my advocate counselor. Her name is Mary Story, and she was wonderful. She did some very wonderful things for me, and things that changed my life, and things that I learned forever from, and I'm eternally grateful to her. But the program folded over a political insight. And the program disappeared, and I reached out to other radical feminists, thinking that what I would get with other radical feminists was what I got from Mary, not realizing that Mary was an advocate counselor. Mary's position was probably more harm reduction, even though I had no idea what harm reduction was at the time. Her position was to support and validate my survival and to teach me survival skills that I hadn't really learned well about boundaries, etc. And when I entered feminism, or radical feminism, I assumed that what I would find was what I found with Mary, and to a large degree, it was not. And the longer that I was in that movement, the more I realized how much harm was being done, and how outlandish I felt the beliefs were, and what really did it in for me were just the, you know, in the early part of this century, you know, 2002, the ethical abuses, the alignment with the Bush administration for the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, this was not the feminism that I knew from Mary's story. This was not a movement that to me that was empowering anybody but the academic elite of the movement. And that it was a movement to me that I couldn't understand the alignment with the Bush administration. I balked at the anti-prostitution pledge. I never during my time as a radical feminist activist bought into the seeing sex workers as enemies or as infiltrators or any of the absurd things that come out of the radical feminist movement. You know, I specifically balked at seeing sex workers as enemies or as collaborators or whatever, you know, and eventually the picture just became clear to me that I didn't belong there, and I was never particularly popular in that movement anyway, and when I finally just spoke out against the abuses that I saw, I was thrown out of the movement, essentially. You know, it all came to a crescendo in Washington, D.C. at a conference, and I left the movement / was thrown out of the movement on very negative terms, in a situation that led to death threats because I took the organization that's now Swap East with me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's this whole bizarre subplot, political subplot to it, but I didn't even really know what the sex worker rights movement was at that point. And when I reached out to sex worker rights activists and told them, you know, this is who I am, I learned more about the movement and found that this was a movement that was pragmatic, it was practical, it was respectful, it was reformist. It made sense to me, and the woman that I ran into, who I had always been, you know, taught or told in radical feminism were evil, pro-prostitution, blah, 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 that wasn't the case at all. Nobody pressured me into anything. You know, and I went to the Desiree Alliance Conference in 2006 and just found that an incredible, welcoming, healing environment that I had really never experienced before in my life, and found that the sex worker rights movement was doing actual, concrete, practical work that was making a difference today. And that the people in the movement were nothing like the propaganda that I had been fed, and so I'm somehow ended up being, you know, my role in the movement has certainly expanded, and you know, that's because so many people, so many wonderful activists in this movement have embraced me and trust in me when they really had no reason to, based upon my radical feminist past, and so, you know, it's been a really incredible transition, and that I'm really glad happened.
And how did you first find out about, you know, sex worker advocacy? How did you first find out about it?
There was a radical feminist event. It was called International Day of No Prostitution. And the long and the short of it is I was a speaker. I was brought out to San Francisco, or Berkeley actually, to speak at that event. Melissa Farley was one of the speakers. There was a speaker from SAGE, Standing Against Global Exploitation. I wasn't part of the planning of that event. I didn't care for the verbiage of the event. I didn't care for the direction of the event. There was a lot about that event I didn't care for. A lot of money was raised to bring me out there to pay my expenses to get out there. So I fulfilled my commitment. But my heart wasn't in it, and the night of the event, there was all this paranoia about how the quote-unquote pro-prostitution side was going to crash the event, and all this paranoia about security issues and blah, 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 and Melissa Farley had this whole angry speech prepared in case, you know, any of the enemy side showed up, and I was just like, you know, what's the deal here? I mean, and I even said it, like, if someone from the other side shows up, why don't we just talk with them? And that was just like this huge faux pas. And then the next night they did this walking tour of the porn district in San Francisco, and I balked at it. I didn't want to do this walking tour. I knew it was going to be confrontational. I didn't want to get into confrontations with sex workers or sex worker rights. And I didn't want to go into some of the hardcore porn stores and see variations of porn that I was harmed in, that I still had not recovered from the victimization that I went through in non-consensual sex work. And yeah, you know, I was pushed into it, and I did it, and I had a lot of emotional difficulty with it. And what I'm driving at with this is that I started looking at the response to International Day of No Prostitution online, and I found a message board called it was called something like the Strap-On Board or something, and the name of it is Taking Care of Business, strapon.org or something to that effect. And there were angry posts about Day of No Prostitution, which essentially stated that it was being run and that the participants in it were all rich elitist college kids. And I gently wrote back, expecting to be flamed and just blasted, saying not all of us were. Matter of fact, you know, I kind of just waited on the line and said, not all of us were these college academics, that not all of us even agreed with the agenda, that the whole thing had gotten to the point where they were bringing animals into, that animals were brought in and victims of prostitution, and the whole thing was just absurd. And but, you know, I said myself, I thought the whole thing was absurd, that I shouldn't have taken part in it, that I didn't even agree with it, and that if somebody wanted to talk with me, I certainly was open to talking, and people reached out to me, and that was how I found it. You know, I Melissa Bitmore and Melissa Dura and Emmy Koyama and Carol Lee reached out to me and talked to me, and they weren't hostile, they weren't aggressive, they were very kind, they were very warm. And the more I talked to them, the more I realized that my own views jibed so much better with theirs. And Carol gave me an invite to attend the Desiree Lyons 2006 in Vegas. and a scholarship to go because I couldn't afford to go, and I was terrified. I remember flying out there on that flight. You know, I was watching thunderstorms. It was like the line of thunderstorms. It seemed like the whole flight out, and listening to my iPod in flight, thinking to myself, "What have I gotten myself into? These people are going to hate me. I'm not going to be trusted. I'm going to get grilled." But it was nothing like that. I mean, nobody expected anything of me. Everybody, I met Stacy and Susan and you and Jill McCracken and Ayula and so many wonderful activists. Kit and Infinite and it was mind-boggling. It was such a warm, tolerant, accepting movement. And I learned so much from it, and that's really where it began for me.
The Israeli Vox, the Deseret Alliance conference, that was really your first experience with a sex worker advocacy event.
Yeah, and
it's great that you still went anyway, even though you were scared, because obviously, I mean, if you're a radical feminist, you are fighting against the causes of this movement. There's definitely reason for concern going, but it's great that people were so accepting of you, and I found the movement to be the same way. I'm really inspired just by the tolerance of this movement, just the hard work of the movement, the resiliency, and I agree, it's just such a great movement, and I usually feel very, just very comfortable, in that atmosphere, and I get a lot of, really good positive energy from it. And it doesn't mean that everything about sex work is positive, but I do get a lot of, positive energy from this movement.
Well, what I've found is that even in areas that we don't all share the same views on, we can all still stand together. Mm-hmm. That, there's a broad spectrum of views, there's a broad spectrum of experiences, and there's certainly disagreement, but we still stand together and we respect each other. And the differences don't divide. They don't divide us. They keep us together instead. And this is just an incredible movement. It's an incredible movement in that I've never really experienced anything like, that there isn't this paranoia or this huge thing for control. Instead, it is just completely... Everybody is just incredibly open and willing to work together and to get by the various problems and to work towards constructive goals. And those things are just really incredible to me. It's a movement that, as I said, I went into really afraid, really worried about what was going to happen. And instead, I was welcomed. I, regardless of the differences in my views and in my background, I was welcomed. People were open with me. And that was where I started learning so much more about the Trafficking Victims Protection Authorization Act. That's where I learned about the harm of TVPRA. And the anti-prostitution oath to such a greater degree.
Absolutely, and I think that's what's important for people to understand, is that sometimes policies that on this, you really need to look beyond the surface, because sometimes policies may seem altruistic on the surface, like, oh, it's they're trying to stop human trafficking, you know, it must be a good policy. I mean, and if this policy was primarily about ending slavery and forced labor, then I would agree with that. But if you look beyond the surface, I mean, and look at the implications of this policy, you can clearly see that it promotes prohibitionist policies that's harming sex workers. And if anything, doing more to encourage trafficking in some senses than stop trafficking, because some of the people being trafficked in the sex industry are people trying to flee persecution because of the criminalization of prostitution. And so you have the U.S. government pressuring these other countries to really increase enforcement of anti-prostitution laws under the guise of stopping human trafficking. But the problem is this isn't stopping human trafficking. What it's resulting in are policies where all prostitution is being criminalized under these trafficking acts, and as a result, sex workers are being persecuted. And what happens when people are being persecuted? Some people will try to flee persecution, and the traffickers will jump in sometimes and take advantage of the situation. But that being said, it's also important for people to understand that not all migrant sex workers are trafficking victims. Men, in the world we live in, people in lots of industries cross borders to make a living, and some of those people work in the sex industry. And sex workers should be able to cross borders safely and legally. And the TVPRA doesn't really allow for that, and there's also a gag order in there denying funding to any organization that refuses to sign an oath opposing legal prostitution. So, and none of this is really doing anything to stop human trafficking. What it's resulted in are very repressive policies where sex workers are being persecuted under laws that are supposed to be about, you know, stopping modern-day slavery. And you have situations like the situation I described in the letter I read about regarding Cambodia.
You know, it's just, unfortunately, from the outset, there's a very, this is a very slick, very glossy campaign done by the prohibitionist people. They were very, very smart in the sense of how they packaged this campaign about quote-unquote anti-trafficking. And I mean, upon first glance, upon first hearing, who wouldn't be opposed to you know, forced human trafficking? I mean, I don't know anyone who's pro-trafficking, you know, and it's nobody is except traffickers, mm-hmm. You know, and but when you dig deeper, you find out that this has really nothing to do with fighting trafficking. This is political. This is a certain aspect of feminists, of right-wing Christians, of politicians, using trafficking as a methodology to control a huge amount of money and to enforce control globally, and to keep anyone opposing them both silent and starving financially. And the people who suffer the most are the people who are supposed to be helped. You know, I mean, Swap East has our own global outreach called Pledging Action, and we're in the process of sending condoms to Chile to sex workers who used to be able to get them in a country where sex work is legal, and they can't get them anymore because of the funding shut off from the United States. And how many died because of the lack of resources? How many died from fatal diseases or just, you know, suffer greatly in the cold Santiago winter because there's no resources because of this funding shut off. Meanwhile, you've got huge amounts of money going to studies by already wealthy academics, and it's just a power play. It's just a political power play. It's about power. It's about politics, and it's about money.
And what you brought up about funding being shut off from the U.S. if you don't sign this anti-prostitution oath, it's basically through the U.S. AIDS, which is an act that offers AIDS-related funding. And like with the TVPRA, under U.S. AIDS, there's like almost an identical gag order where you have to sign an anti-prostitution oath in order to receive funding. And some of these organizations are doing like really great work, great HIV/AIDS prevention work with sex workers, and they don't want sex workers to be criminalized or arrested, and they want to, you know, provide needed beneficial services. They don't want to promote policies that harm sex workers, such as the criminalization of prostitution, so they won't sign these pledges, and therefore they're losing money. I know, like, the country of Brazil lost, I think it is, you might have heard about this, like $4 million or something in funds from the U.S. because Brazil wouldn't sign the anti-prostitution pledge in USAIDS. And, of course, USAIDS was run by, or the leader of it was Randall Tobias, or Tobias, I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce his last name, but he was, you might have heard of him, he was one of the politicians who used Deborah Palfrey's escort service. He used the services of sex workers, basically, and then he's, you know, run some organization with an anti-prostitution pledge, even though, you know, he was using, you know, prostitution services. And I'm like, how hypocritical is that? And then, you know, a few months later, maybe about a year later, the whole Elliot Spitzer scandal breaks out. So it's like all this hypocrisy and this prohibitionist side, like some of the, you know, anti-prostitution champions, the champions for the anti-prostitution cause, turn out to be clients of prostitutes themselves. I mean, and it's just all this hypocrisy. And USAIDS, the organization with that gag order, was run by somebody who was very hypocritical. And this gag order really does nothing to benefit anybody, except, I don't know, maybe the people who are profiting off of the criminalization of prostitution. I don't know, but just all this hypocrisy.
It's just another example of a war by the Bush administration, which ostensibly was supposed to be, you know, this good thing that was presented as this good thing, but it turned out to be just another farce to line the pockets of a certain sector of people. You know, I'm astonished at the things that have happened under the Bush administration. Uh-huh. You know, the cost of oil, the huge amounts of funding that have gone into the quote unquote, you know, anti-trafficking war, that is lining the pockets of corrupt politicians and disingenuous researchers, you know, and some of whom are hiring sex workers. And to, you know, to me, the problem isn't that they're hiring sex workers. The problem is that they're fighting to take away rights for sex workers. They're in many cases, essentially killing sex workers around the world through their funding strangulation. And yet they're hiring them at the same time on the payroll. And it's just mind-numbing. It's just wow, you know?
No. Exactly.
You know, the Swap East, back right when I split with the radical feminist movement, we had a $10,000 grant in hand that only needed a signature that came down to that anti-prostitution oath, and I couldn't sign it. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't sign it, and this was when I really hadn't even barely touched the sex worker rights movement. And you know, I wasn't an active sex worker rights activist then. You know, but I couldn't sign that because it signing that pledge that wiped out everything that we were going to do with that grant, which was to provide services to active sex workers. You know, I mean, we had a 24-hour staffed crisis line. We had, and this was Minneapolis based. We had active legal advocacy programs. We had, you know, things as simple as you know, warm clothing donation. You know, and for anybody that's spent a winter in Minneapolis, it's an astonishingly cold place.
Yeah.
And $10,000 was all the money in the world for us, and you know, I turned it away, and you know, we're still not funded, and how much harm and how much was lost by sex workers that we could have helped because of that.
Exactly, and I think, you know, the taking the pledge video, it's posted online. It's really a 13-minute documentary that really addresses the harms of these gag orders, with a focus on the U.S. AIDS gag order and how this gag order harms sex workers and organizations supportive of sex workers, you know, just because they won't sign some, you know, anti-prostitution oath. And I mean, if the purpose of this is to fight AIDS and stop AIDS and provide services for people with AIDS, then why should it matter whether you support, you know, legal prostitution or not? I mean,
well, and you can't take away, you can't take away condoms or the money to buy the condom as a methodology of fighting HIV.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just... And when I try to discuss this with many radical feminists, they immediately flip it to, you know, all the degrading aspects of porn over and over and over. And it's like there are problems that need to be addressed that are more urgent than degradation in hardcore porn. You know, at least as far as I'm concerned, you know, whether somebody's going to live or die as a result of HIV, whether somebody is going to live or die because they're going to freeze and they're homeless in a cold weather city, or they're starving wherever, or they're going to die of HIV, those to me are more of a priority than this whole focus on you know, what aspect of porn is degrading and harmful to women. And you know, I'm not a big porn advocate. I don't watch it. I don't care. Mm-hmm. You know, and there are certainly aspects of porn that I don't have an appreciation for. There are aspects of porn that I myself am opposed to, and feel are, you know, do harm, and certainly, you know, kitty porn and bestiality porn, and you know, I mean, those are horrific, and the producers and the buyers of those need to be in prison. But that can't be. We can't make the fight so monolithic against them that we kill how many sex workers by because they can't get a condom in that process.
Exactly. And that's a good point, because, I mean, they talk about how porn's so harmful. Well, I mean, isn't it also harmful to deny sex workers, you know, condoms or just other things that may be needed that can potentially save them their lives. I mean, isn't that also harmful? I mean, don't the radical feminists also see that? It's almost like they, in a sense, kind of like trivialize this whole issue, like the whole issue of HIV/AIDS, like, oh, well, that's really, I mean, act like it's almost kind of secondary to, you know, how patriarchal sex work is. And I was reading something written by a radical, I could name her, but I'm not going to, but people probably know who she is. So anyway, there's something written online. It said, you know, something along, I don't have it right in front of me, but it said something along the line, like, criticizing, like, the sex worker advocates acting like, these people act like all that they really need are a condom and a cup of coffee. I'm like, well, what sex workers really need are rights, our labor, civil, human rights. I mean, that's what sex workers need, not just a cup of coffee. So again, it's almost like trivial, the way she would say that, just a condom and a cup of coffee, it's almost like trivializing the efforts of sex workers to protect oneself from these sexually transmitted diseases, which is a very important issue. It's a primary issue, not the only primary issue, but it's one of them.
Well, you know, and I hate to disappoint that researcher that wrote it, but the sex worker, you know, without the condom in Santiago or Phnom Penh or in Bangkok or in Minneapolis, they need that condom. They need their rights a lot more than they need porn magazines taken off the shelf. And their needs, I hate to pass judgments, and I don't mean it as a judgment, but their needs are more urgent than that of the woman, you know, the average woman who's in, you know, the convenience store and sees a porn magazine and is unhappy about it. You know, it's comparing dangers, you know, does that mean that the woman in the convenience store doesn't have the right to own her feelings? Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. You know, but her life is not imminently on the line from that porn magazine, whereas, you know, the sex worker that has no rights, that has no condom, that is freezing, that's life-threatening right now. You know, and I think it has to do with priority.
Exactly. And thank you so much for joining us, Jill. One of the things I think is so important is that if you, as somebody who has experienced working in both the forced and consensual sectors of the sex industry, can differentiate between forced and consensual sex work, there's no reason for the rest of us not to. And I think that's so powerful. And is there any way, in terms of Sex Workers Against Rape campaign, do you have any contact information, like any email address or phone number people can, you know, contact you at if they're interested?
They can get me through Swap East. We really haven't said anything formal yet. The best way to reach me would be through Swap East, which is swapeast.org, SWOPEAST.org.
Okay.
And just scroll through the contact list. And we've got, there's a telephone number. I don't have it in front of me. It's a 202 area code.
Mm-hmm. They can look it up.
They can look it up on the Swap East website. They can also email any Swap East member.
Thank you so much for joining us, Jill. We're about out of time. And thank you all for listening. And the next XBN broadcast, the next scheduled one at this point, will be on Wednesday evening, The Call of Gracie. So be sure to go to www.xbn.net for details. And again, thank you so much for joining us. My name is Holly Pottle, and our guest tonight is Jill Brenneman.
Well, thank you for having me, Holly. It's been a pleasure, and it's been great to be a guest.
Yeah. it was great having you here. You provided, you know, such great information, and we do, I'm seeing the ticker showing like we have 40 seconds left, so do you have anything you'd like to add before we run out of time?
Just, you know, for people who are looking at the trafficking, the anti-trafficking measures, I'd ask them to take another look and really look at what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So important, understanding the implications of policies, and that's the only way we'll be able to form effective public policies, is if we really take the time to educate ourselves about these policies. Well, good night, everybody. And I guess that's all. Are you still here? Jill?